comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show, and all of you who are joining us for the very, very first time, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. It is talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, I guarantee you, and we're glad you're here. Hope you make a habit out of it. Since Sunday, I've been getting email wanting to know about this graphic that is on our website that says days left to extinction. And a couple of reasons that's up there. First of all, it's true. Secondly, it was suggested by one of our listeners, one of our members, that I put a graphic up there so people could actually see as we count down to extinction for the Kevin Smith Show. The situation is quite simply this. I've been stating, I've been putting it in the K-Files e-zine, I've been stating it on the show, that things are quite critical. And because of the economic downturn, many people have lost their jobs. And when they lose their jobs, then what they have to spend on discretionary items, like the membership, they have to cut that out because, you know, they have to find some way to survive. We have experienced about a 2/3 loss in revenue, and we were just barely meeting the expenses to keep the show going. I've been saying it, I've been telling it, and some people believed it. Some people thought, it's just one of those things that it'll pass. Well, it will pass in 9 days from now. The Kevin Smith Show will come to a screeching halt, except that we will continue to be able to broadcast minimally in the members' area. But it will come to a halt. It will be over 9 years behind us, and it will be done unless we are able to raise the money to pay the rent for the studio, pay the utilities to keep the cable service and telephone service going. And we're about $500 away now from being able to do that. I want to thank everyone who's been donating and those who have made purchases just in order to help. Listen, I appreciate it, truly appreciate it. I think we'll probably make it, but if we don't, then whatever's supposed to happen will happen. And, you know, if folks around the world don't want the show, we will know. And then I will not be working 100 hours a week in vain. But if folks around the world want the show, then folks will step to the plate and help us survive. And with my eternal thanks and gratitude. But each day as we clock down towards D-Day, more of that picture gets blacked out, as you have noticed. So that's what that's all about. It's just so that you can see that it is the truth. It is not a joke. It is real. And when we get down to day one, we will do our last show. And unless we are able to come up with the money to keep the studio and utilities. All right, folks. My guest this evening is T. Allen Greenfield, and we're going to be talking about Men in Black, not the movie. All right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is T. Allen Greenfield. Mr. Greenfield is both a student and an authority on unusual phenomena. He is a past elected member of the British Society for Psychical Research and the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena from 1960. He has twice been the recipient of the Ufologist of the Year Award of the National UFO Conference, 1972 and 1992, which has run continuously on an annual basis now for over four decades. We could go on and on about his background and his credentials. He is an expert in the occult and has a great deal of knowledge about the topic which we are going to delve into tonight. Allen Greenfield, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
I'm delighted to be here.
First, let me sort of introduce the topic that I want us to explore with you tonight. And that is the MIBs, the Men in Black. Now, there was a period of time in the realm of ufology when we were hearing a great deal about Men in Black. We were hearing about it. We were seeing movies about it. We were reading about it. It was on radio talk shows. People were reporting it. And it seems somewhat to have died down, at least the attention that it's getting seems to have died down. But is this where I want us to begin. Do you consider this Men in Black to be a very real phenomenon, or do you think it's people's imagination running wild with them?
Well, that's a several, I've got several different answers to that, all of which I find to be truthful in their own realm. First of all, of course, there are people who will read a book, and then every UFO investigator that shows up at their door with a tape recorder and Ray-Bans on after they've had a UFO experience will conclude that's a Man in Black. And there are some people who are just paranoid. I mean, the number of UFO events happening worldwide is enormous. That alone should be cause for concern. But with that kind of volume of cases and a lot of lore out there starting way back when my late friend Gray Barker wrote they knew too much about the flying saucers and coined the term Men in Black, some people are bound to reach those conclusions on, shall we say, a very easy basis. However, there are two very real phenomena that go on, one far more mysterious than the other, one which I have run down and explained and to my own satisfaction, which is at times, there, starting in 1953, there have been efforts on the part of government agencies, I believe mostly involving the CIA, which isn't supposed to be doing a lot of things domestically, at least not prior to 9/11, who have just gone to the door of various witnesses to various phenomena and have tried to scare the bejesus out of people and often have succeeded. Of course, on the other hand, people, when they get scared, sometimes become more talkative. The reason for that was told to me by Major Dewey Fournay, who for some years, key to this, going back to 1952, was the Air Force Pentagon monitor of Project Blue Book, or if it was earlier than that, it was called Project Grudge. But in any case, he was an insider, and He told me personally way back about 1976 or so in an extensive interview exactly what had happened. In July 1952, as most people who follow UFO lore know, there were sightings of UFOs over restricted airspace in Washington, D.C., and there were radar sightings, there were visual sightings by jets that were scrambled to find out what was going on, and of course in those days of the Cold War, the first thought was a Soviet invasion, the second thought was these don't fit the description of any Soviet bombers that anyone has ever seen, nor did the radar images reflect.
Now, are these the cluster of UFOs that was photographed going over the Capitol?
July 1952, yes, mm-hmm. sir. They were.
Okay.
It was headline news all over the country.
Yeah, it made it to Life magazine even.
From that. In fact, that was my first exposure to UFOs, hearing my parents talk about that particular event, and that, even as a small child, that sort of perked up my ears, but suffice to say this, shortly thereafter, and we have to keep in mind the climate of the times, Cold War, McCarthy era, etc., the CIA convened a panel to discuss any security risks, not so much from alien invasion, but the fact that our entire security system, from the Ground Observer Corps to radar and telephone contacts, were flooded with UFO reports that night. Even the traffic of jets in flight reporting back to their command and control centers were full of UFO talk, and there was a fear that civilian UFO organizations, which were only then getting organized, would in fact become infiltrated by communist agents who would help to generate a UFO flap at a time when a real Soviet invasion was going on, and they would be so busy looking for UFOs that by the time they sorted it out, we would have been vaporized. And thereafter, there were a number of cases that looked suspiciously like government agents who were out to scare people and implied that they were something other than government agents, or alternately, saying that they were government agents and swearing people to silence, which, as I say, in some cases works with people, in some cases not. That would be a rational explanation. It's certainly the explanation for some of the early cases, and even some as recently as a very odd UFO encounter in along the California-Nevada border about a year ago, and which involved some sort of craft that apparently crashed, was picked up by a black helicopter, taken away to one of those infamous areas, Area 51, 52, 53. 52 is in Tonopah, Nevada, or outside of Tonopah, and that's a place that I know particularly well. There are also a lot of perfectly legitimate security concerns there, but then there were men in black all over the place, and they seemed to have been government agents, but they were not dressed that way. They were dressed like truckers and driving ordinary 18-wheel rigs, and looked for all the world like. However, they intimidated several television and radio crews, who the next day were not talking about the pickup of the UFO so much as they were talking about how great our government is in guarding our nuclear arsenal buried out in the Nevada desert. So these things go on, but there's a separate, though I think somewhat mimicking a type of men in black cases that start out a long time before there even was the CIA, before there was the United States, in fact, and coming forward in time seem to reflect people's expectations, but for all the world, their descriptions fit those of gray aliens dressed up like human beings. They tend to be either very short or very, very large. They seem to run out of energy, to vaporize. And these cases they also intimidate people, and I have seen enough of these cases to think that the gray aliens, as reported over many years, and the third class of men in black, those that are not hysteria or government agents, are in fact directly interactive with the UFO phenomena, and they may not quite be physical beings or even living beings as we understand it, but they sure try to put on that appearance, although I would say, from the close-up descriptions, not very well.
Let me ask a question before we go much further. Let me ask a question before we go much further, something that you said I just want to get clarification on. You said that this is a mimicking type of Men in Black case, but then you said it happens, it goes back before we started seeing these government agents. How is it mimicking, or what is it mimicking, if it happened before these government agents started showing up?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question. It depends on the times, what they would mimic. Now, there are medieval cases where people describe a visit from the Man in Black. And the Man in Black was considered, in the wisdom of the Middle Ages, or lack thereof, as the devil himself visiting. These, in turn, resembled the visitor of the Inquisitor knocking on the door. Inquisitors tended to wear the same type of garb that they were seen in at that time. They tended to be threatening and implying that if you don't comply with their beliefs, that awful things will happen to you. In the case of the Inquisitors, awful things did happen to people. As you move forward in time, they mimic other cultural ideas of the time, but always some terrestrial authority, only they don't quite make it, because people often see through the mimicry of the time, and to their credit, they say, there was something not quite human about this being. Of course, if you're thinking it's the devil, that might make that a more plausible thing than if you're thinking it's an Air Force agent and he walks out of your door looking like he's run out of energy, has no vehicle, and disappears into thin air. That clearly is not any kind of government agent of any kind of earthly government that we would recognize.
So what they were mimicking would be something with which the people at the time would already be familiar.
Yes, and also authority figures. That would be the that would be if there's intention involved, and I don't profess to know the intention of truly alien minds. It does seem to be that they are trying to intimidate by duplicating authority figures. And in the case of modern times, I think perhaps the visitations by Air Force personnel, CIA agents out to intimidate private UFO organizations out of existence, several of which they were successful at. It didn't take too much. I mean, ufology started out as a hobby, and so the people were rarely willing to risk their lives and futures for it. Then the whatever they are showed up in similar garb. They just didn't look human. Again, they tended to be 5'1" or 6'4" and 400 pounds. Not the sort of people that you would expect at all. The mimicry may be intentionally flawed. I mean, we could go off into various speculations, but I think what it comes down to is that there is a certain plasticity to whatever these alien beings are, and the plasticity is that it uses something out of our own culture or maybe out of our own minds to create a projection. And that being the case, I think that you can expect that it, in time, it tends to change. But the purpose apparently remains the same because the modus operandi remains the same.
So, why do you suspect they run out of energy? I mean, is it like they're on batteries or something?
They don't use the Energizer Bunny. My best guess, and it's only that, just based on some knowledge of plasma phenomena, electrical phenomena, and so forth, and for that matter, some unorthodox energy theories like dark matter, and dark matter is almost an orthodox theory. They just can't quite find it. But orgone energy or whatever, these creatures that have this plasticity are not physical. If you touch them at the moment of their greatest strength, you probably would be touching something that seemed physical. But they do seem to involve a certain amount of energy that they get in a sort of vampiric way. That is, that they draw from the fear of the witnesses. They are attracted to the wonderment and fear that that witnesses to UFO cases have, and they seem to draw on that energy. As that energy winds down, they wind down, and eventually they disappear, although they try not to do that in front of anybody. And that some of that is speculation, but I think that's about as close as we're going to get without some way of approaching this, which, again, I have a couple of different hats. One of them is paranormal research and occultism, and on the other hand, ufology, subjects that don't get along very well. The ufologists dislike my association with the occult, and the occultists dislike my association with ufology.
So everybody's upset with you.
Actually, I think I have a lot of people these days in the middle, but that took me two books and many lectures in order to get some people to find what I have to say plausible. Well, and after nearly 50 years in the field, I suppose I have developed some people who give some credit to what I say. My books sell fairly well, so I assume, as UFO books go these days. So. You did ask me a question. I didn't quite meet it, and I've run into this question before. There seem to be less Men in Black cases now.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I hear that, I go, well, the answer there is probably the strangest answer of all. The reason that is seems to be true is because virtually all of the investigators who specialized in Men in Black cases died, mostly prematurely, with one exception.
All right, we have to pause for a break, Alan, and we'll get the rest of that answer when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, we have to step away for a few minutes for this break. We'll be back with Alan Greenfield and the rest of that answer in just a moment. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Alan Greenfield, and we're talking about Men in Black. He's one of the premier ufologists in the United States of America. And you were just about to tell us, Alan, why there seems to be fewer cases of Men in Black being brought to public attention now. Are you with me, Alan? Well, we seem to have lost Alan. Okay, well, we will attempt to get him back on the line and see if we can reestablish contact with him here. Ah, yes, it ringeth, so... Alan, I don't know what happened. Our
I'm going to talk about the Men in Black.
Yeah.
You can listen to MP3s of programs that always, people who never have any problems with their communication, something like that always happens. I've gotten used to it.
Well, we get hit all the time, so we're not surprised. We got hit last night, so we're not surprised. Well, and anyway, you were about to tell us why there seem to be fewer of these Men in Black reports being brought to public attention now.
Well, obviously, I get any number of, I mean, I don't solicit them. I'm not a reporting center for UFO cases. There are other people like the MUFON people who are better equipped to keep track of cases. But I get my share of emails on this, that, and the other. And I would say I get about four decent Men in Black cases a year unsolicited, and I file them, or if it's feasible, I investigate them and pass them along to those that are better equipped to investigate them in person when there are people. But the problem is that most of the UFO investigators who specialized in the Men in Black cases have died under mysterious circumstances, most of them in their 40s and 50s. We just lost one of the premier Men in Black investigators, but John Keel, God rest his soul, but he was 79. That's obviously no great mystery. He had a long and full life and a sad ending in his latter years. But what I'm talking about are investigators in the prime of life and who have specialized in this area, often been threatened, ignored the threats as opposed to those who take them, and then something bad happens to them. In fact, a fair example are the authors who were associated with Illuminate Press, which, by the way, was my first publisher as well. They know the press itself was eventually a victim of whatever nefarious schemes are going on. But the key people who were doing both UFO and Men in Black and conspiracy theories died under the most peculiar of circumstances, including and ending with my late friend Ron Bonds, the publisher of Illuminate Press. And before it was Illuminate Press, it was a BBS on the, what passed for the Internet before the actual Internet. Ron went to dinner one night with his wife, ate at a local restaurant. No one else there got sick, including his wife, who was, you know, also dining there. Became horribly ill within a few minutes of being there and died of what was listed as food poisoning. I have checked with all kinds of authorities, and there are lots of things that will kill you that quickly, but not food poisoning. That's a long and drawn-out ordeal, and there's usually a chance of saving a person. But he was dead within hours, and that was the end of Illuminate Press. But before him, Jim Keith, who was expert in conspiracy theory cases going back to Kennedy assassination theories, up through the casebook for the Men in Black, in which he had some kind things to say about me. I knew Jim quite well. He was in his 40s. He had a not sprained, but strained ankle and was dead in a couple of days. No explanation.
From a strained ankle?
Okay.
The guy strains his ankle and it kills him?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I'm just giving you the official explanation. I don't think Ron Bonds died of food poisoning. I don't think Kerry Thornley died of chronic kidney disease, which he had, but he also, being a very streetwise person, fell out of an eighth floor window, which he inexplicably was apparently hanging out of. or Frank Edwards, whose last words were, I have the strangest feeling. On June 24th, 1967, I heard about it from Gray Barker, who died under the, who was the great expert on Men in Black, and who died under, well, you hear all kinds of really nasty stories, but he died of a long and lingering unknown illness right after writing the book MIB, The Terror Among Us, and had been responsible for many others. The point being that people in their 40s and 50s don't ordinarily, in the course of events, if they don't have an accident or they don't have really bad luck, don't tend to, that is not the lifespan that one would expect of persons previously in good health of that age. But we've basically lost the people who most reported these cases. And therefore, the cases are there, but they're not examined as closely, just because there are not people who specialize in them, or not very many. And John Keel was the last of the great ones. He, of course, had been retired for more or less for the last 20 years. He wrote essentially one really long book and then divided it up, and over the years it was published as a series of books. And eventually, the one that he wrote on, the second best book on the Mothman thing, which had a lot of Men in Black cases associated with it, was turned into a rather good film, in my opinion. And all that did was pay for his eye surgery, as he put it. But he died under, you know, normal circumstances. These other people, it's all very weird, and I tend not to be a conspiracy theorist, but these were all friends of mine or close acquaintances. I would say the only one that would be on my list of people who didn't heed the warnings of the Men in Black and died under mysterious, very mysterious circumstances was M.K. Jessup. The others were all people that I knew quite well, so I take this rather personally, and don't get around to the question of, well, why haven't they gone after me? Because I don't have a really good answer.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever encountered any men in black?
That gives me some protection.
Yeah. Have you ever encountered any men in black?
Once. And it was a long time ago. And I was able to take a picture of this thing. I tried to keep this particular story out of print. It's not in any of my books or anything. I've only recently begun to talk about it, the reason being having nothing to do with fear of consequences or anything, but I try to stay objective, and if I say I saw one, you know, that puts you in a different category. But this was with a lot of other witnesses. I was attending the, if I recall correctly, the 1969 National UFO Conference, which was in Charleston, West Virginia. And the convention was held there that year because this was on the coattails of the Silver Bridge disaster, the Mothman cases, the many UFO cases that accompanied that, and the many Men in Black cases that accompanied that. I noticed a guy who had been sort of not part of the convention crowd, but had been shadowing the convention and following people around at a sort of respectful distance. And other people didn't seem to pay any attention to him, but he was, you know, he had all of those earmarks of the gray aliens trying to dress up as people, that he had the dark glasses, the dark hat, the dark coat, a generally strange appearance, and walked in an unusual way, two steps forward, one step to the side, which has often been noted. And I really wasn't going to do anything about it, but during those days, I did a lot of documentary photography. So I did have a good 35-millimeter camera, which I was using to take pictures of the convention. I did a lot of black and white work in those days because it was good for low light without using flash. And I had that with me. We adjourned the convention, went to lunch, and the guy came over to us and just stood behind the group of people I was with, and of course then everyone noticed him because he was there. And I was preoccupied with a chair that I was sitting in that was kind of loose, and I was afraid I was going to fall on my backside, but I used that as an excuse to stand up, and I said, I don't really recognize you, and I've been to all of these conventions. Who are you? And he said in this totally mechanical voice, I am a man in black in training. I can't even imitate the voice. It sounds like a computer-generated voice. And at that point, I thought about taking a picture of him. Didn't say anything. Thought about that. I may have made, you know, hand gestures or whatever with my, grabbed at my camera. He turned around and went out into the street in Charleston. Now, this was on a Sunday, so there were not very many people in the street. I followed him. I went out into the street and got out in front of him and snapped a photo of him. When you look in your email, you will find a copy of that photo. In any case, he didn't like it, but he stood there for a moment, and then he went around a corner, and I rounded the corner after him, wanting to take some other pictures or annoy him in some way until I found out who or what he was. He was gone. He was disappeared. I looked for doorways. I looked for, you know, other explanations, a taxi, a car, anything. It was Sunday in Charleston, West Virginia in the 1960s. So as my father used to say, on a bad business day, you could shoot a cannonball on the street and not hit anybody. I have no explanation for that. I didn't actually see him vanish in thin air, but essentially he was out of sight.
Now, is this a color photograph or a black and white?
No, it's a black and white. It was taken with Tri-X Pan, the definitive black and white film.
400 ASA.
Beg pardon? Yeah.
Yeah, 400 ASA. It's a high speed.
In broad daylight.
Well, that's good because it's high contrast, and you can get good sharp pictures with that.
Exactly.
And you can stop motion with it, so that's good. So you got a pretty good clear photograph of this guy?
Cold. Beg pardon?
You got a good clear photograph of this guy?
Absolutely. It's one of the two photos that I can of men in black of this sort that I can vouch for directly, because that one was taken by me, and while there weren't any witnesses to the photo, there was nobody on the street but me and this thing. The people who saw him and took note of it and saw him at the table would be half the people who were mockers, big guys in ufology of that period. Some of whom have gone on to the great saucer in the sky, some of whom are still around. So it was, the right place, right time. That's the only experience I've ever had of that sort. And there was no, personal threat directed at me or anything. It was just, he was just following us around, and I called him on it, and he disappeared on me, but not before I got my one shot. I would have gotten more if he had been around the corner.
All right, we have to pause for a break, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is T. Allen Greenfield, and we are talking about men in black. Allen, when we went to break, we were discussing this encounter you had with a man in black. Let me ask a couple of questions about that guy. First of all, how tall was he?
I would guess 5'4", 5'5".
Could you tell the color of hair, or did he have hair?
He had hair. It was black and thin.
Mm-hmm.
He was wearing dark glasses, but they seemed to be glasses within glasses, as in dark glasses over some other type of glasses. He was not wearing a clip-on. That was my first impression, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
So it would be sort of like...
he was the classic. He was dressed in black from head to toe, except he was wearing what they used to call an alpine-type hat, which was gray, as I recall. Actually, though it's a black-and-white photo, you can pretty well make out exactly how he was dressed, because he might as well have, in color, he would have been in black-and-white anyway.
What about his skin color?
It was that pale, pasty skin that people often report. Very pale, very pasty. There seemed to have, I'm not a dermatologist, but a lot of acne or other, he seemed to be quite young, and yet he spoke in a way that was not that way at all. His skin looked vampiric. It looked like, I have been around people who have passed out, and his skin was the color of someone just before they pass out.
All right, now, you mentioned that he had a strange walk. I've read a lot about men in black. That's one detail I've never picked up. Is you said like two steps forward and one to the side. Is that common among these genuine men in black?
Yeah, it is common, and Gray Barker documented that in his book, The Silver Bridge, which has just been recently reissued. In fact, I had written the original introduction in 1970 when I was not a great writer. I was quite young and inexperienced. But I did have the opportunity to write a new introduction. The publishers wanted to do that, so that's available through the usual sources. I would read that because Gray really, he lived in West Virginia. He was around men in black cases. I don't think he ever saw one himself unless he was sitting at the table that day with me. And in probability, he was. But he died for the men in black mystery. I mean, like I said, the Silver Bridge is out, and they're about to bring out a new edition with an introduction that I did of MIB, The Terror Among Us, and it should be available from Amazon and the usual sources. It's an interesting book in light of the fact that he died under such mysterious circumstances right when that book was going to press.
Is he the one that fell off the balcony?
No, that was I shouldn't be laughing at it. My friend Kerry Thornley, the author of the Principia Discordia, and a person who had a hand in a lot of different universes, some in the occult, some in the he's sort of one of the grandfathers of the, and he wasn't that old, but of the Discordian movement and the subgenius idea. He also was a figure in the Kennedy assassination case. I don't want to get too far afield, but he was actually called by Jim Garrison as a hostile witness. He was a friend of Lee Harvey Oswald in the Marine Corps before the Kennedy assassination, and in fact had written a book about Oswald before the assassination called The Idle Warriors, which was in turn published by Illuminate Press, owned by Ron Bonds, who also died under mysterious circumstances. I mean, the web here is, you know, one or two of these could be freak accidents or whatever, but you put it all together, it has a very ominous sound, and I'm glad I've never been threatened by these people, because it would be, I guess, a test of manhood, as we used to say in my generation, because whether I would stick with it or not. I suppose if they threatened my children, that would be no question, I would step back from it. But so far, either I'm on the wrong track and I'm not worth it, or they haven't bothered to threaten me. But the two steps forward, one to the side, he turned not as he went, as Gray put it, which is a phrase from the Book of Ezekiel, is fairly common in these cases. Always their way of walking is unusual, but that kind of stepping in a somewhat robotic fashion, as if it were pre-programmed, is close to universal.
You don't. You talk about men in black. You talk about men in black. You write about men in black. And here we are discussing all these strange circumstances under which so many of the men in black investigators have died. And yet you don't sound as if you're very concerned. Would that be because they haven't threatened you, or is it something you do think about?
No, I have, believe me, during the period when the Illuminati people were dying off, you know, one at a time, I actually got a few friends, not in the UFO field, but more from the occult side of things, who called me and said, "Are you okay?" And I would say, "Yeah, as okay as I ever am." And they, "Look, I'm 62 years old. I have a 37-year-old son who's a screenwriter, and one 19, one 17. My attitude is, where I'm concerned, I take walks late at night. I'm fairly exposed. I'm also a diehard. I'm a fairly tough cookie, and you know, I don't have any illusions that I can't be eliminated. But nobody's going to say he died young, and so I keep on keeping on. I'm not trying to exhibit bravado, and I certainly wouldn't urge other people to dare them to bring it on, you know, but nevertheless.
Well, no, because when you've
never been threatened, and my specialty is a little bit different. If you read either of my books, Secret Cipher, The Euphonauts, or Secret Rituals of the Men in Black, they take a somewhat different a radically different approach, really. They're both available free in PDF right now, by the way. Just Google the names of the book, and you'll find the PDF, and you can download it. It's between the original print, which ran out, now that I think about it, that was published by Illuminati, too, so they're not going to be publishing anything else. And there's a new publisher that will pick it up, but for the time being, I'm offering it, you know, free to anybody who wants it in PDF format on Scribd. So.
And where can they get it?
All you have to do is, you mean the hard copy or the PDF?
The PDF.
All you have to do is go to your Google, type in Secret Cipher of the Euphonauts, and separately, Secret Rituals of the Men in Black, and the letters PDF, and they will come up, and you download it, and it's free, and it looks exactly like the hard copy version without the price tag.
Okay.
I always take donations, but I mean, it's free right now, and I would rather the information continue to get out there between, you know, first and second publication than it not get out there. That I do make such living as I do that way, but I think the information is a lot more important than you know, getting residuals or anything like that.
Do you still appear at conferences as a speaker?
Do I speak on the subject?
Yeah, do you still appear at conferences as a speaker on these subjects?
Yeah, rarely. As I've gotten older, I've traveled less. I mean, I'm not in, you know, I'm not in a wheelchair or anything, but I don't go as often as I used to, but I'll probably be at depending on invitations, at the Mothman Convention. But I do a lot of doing what I'm doing right now. I do a lot of podcasts, radio programs, and I've even I've been on the twice on the History Channel, the UFO Hunters. But conventions in general, and I think this is just me, it has nothing to do with the conventions.
I hate to cut you off. We have to. Break is taking over. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, T. Allen Greenfield. We're talking about these men in black. Now, let me ask the $64,000 question, Alan.
Okay.
First, let me set it up. As I understand what you've said, there are some Men in Black encounters that really are not of extraterrestrial origin. They are some type of government agents. Okay?
Correct.
And then these, and they go around and tell people, you didn't see what you saw. What you think you saw, you did not see. And you will never talk about it, or terrible things will happen to you. So they threaten people, and in some cases, frighten them into silence. Then there are these Men in Black that are of extraterrestrial origin, or if not extraterrestrial, certainly not human. And these guys run out of energy pretty quick, walk funny, have pasty skin, and they mimic that same thing. They're telling people, don't talk. Why would the extraterrestrials be going about doing the same thing that agents who are human are doing? Why? What's their purpose? What are they up to?
Well, that is probably the $128,000 question. My feeling is this, and it's a little complex, so bear with me for a minute.
Sure.
I think I have an advantage in the sense that my experience in the occult world and in the paranormal investigations world has served me well in ufology and vice versa. I wish there was more interchange between people in those various areas. And one of the things that I think there's a lot of prima facie evidence for is that these beings are energy related. They're less physical than we are. They are more in the nature of what if I were in the occult world, I would call a magical conjuration. Famously, probably the most famous Men in Black case was that of Albert K. Bender, who last I heard was still living, although totally out of ufology. His case was during the period when these government-type cases were coming up, but clearly his wasn't. And yet he had his home for whatever reason, he was a dabbler in a number of different fields, fixed up in a very occult manner. A lot of occult symbols, Masonic symbols, a lot of... if he were setting out to conjure up a demon from hell, which he's never said that he did, nor has anyone else ever said it, except I'm suggesting that if you create the right kind of energy vortex, you're going to attract a certain type of energy. And immediately after that, the Men in Black show up. They give him a magic word to call them back. The magic word is Kaik. It only worked for him, but it's spelled K-A-Z-I-K, and the question is, well, then why is it pronounced Kaik? All of those things are characteristic of magical conjurations. They're also characteristics of a lot of apparition-type cases, that is, ghosts, not apparitions of the Virgin Mary or anything of that sort. Although, who knows, maybe those are in the same category as well. My feeling is that these mimic creatures draw energy from the community, from the gestalt of the time, and they draw energy from the fear and wonderment that comes out of the UFO experience for the experiencer, for the what John Keel called the percipients, that is, those who see the UFO, who have the abduction experience, who have the near abduction experience. They exhibit a lot of fear, and sometimes before they've even told their neighbors, let alone the police, let alone the newspapers or anybody outside of anything, that type of Man in Black, the type that seem to be low energy beings show up, and the more frightened the person becomes, the longer they stay. The less frightened, the less they stay. I think they are drawing on human energy, certain types of energy, all of it negative of one sort or another, fright being a principal one, to create themselves and recreate themselves from moment to moment, sort of like a hologram in a sense.
So then you would not be of the opinion that they are necessarily extraterrestrial.
You're correct. I'm not opposed to the extraterrestrial hypothesis because I don't know. But I think it more likely that this is something to do with what Jacques Vallée in his more pro-UFO days called Magonia, the fairyland, the land of shadows that coexists with us on Earth and has been described in various terms for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. However, that is just my take on it. I think that there are people who are diehard nuts and bolts people who want, first of all, they want the government to have great secrets about the UFOs. I'm pretty sure I know more than any government agency does about UFOs, and I don't really know all that much after 50 years. So, but I know more than they do. Their investigations are pretty slipshod and superficial. And if they ever reveal what they have, there are some valuable cases, but their level of knowledge is zilch. My opinion is that we need to look. We hear from a lot of ufologists, well, we haven't gotten anywhere since around 1980, and I think the reason for that, and I think there is some truth in that, is because of the fixation of a false dichotomy. That is, UFOs are either alien beings from another planet, somewhere out there. It used to be Mars when I first got involved. Well, they're not from Mars, clearly. Might be from another planet around a star, a nearby star, or it might be for those people who really don't comprehend what the universe is actually like and what amazing distances are involved, from another galaxy, whatever that may mean. Could be. I certainly credit the notion that in ancient times there may have been one visitation, perhaps an ancient Sumer from some extraterrestrial civilization that had an impact on early development of civilization on Earth. Even Carl Sagan copped to that at one point. But I think it less likely than it has some kind of association with us as human beings and has a lot of association with the Earth itself. I suspect that wherever we go in the universe, assuming we go anywhere in the universe, they'll come with us because they're in a certain sense, a part of our immediate environment.
Well, this is...
And it manifests.
This is getting away from the topic of Men in Black. What I'm about to ask is, but in a way, it isn't. In a way, it isn't.
Whose question worth, and do I get my $64,000?
Yeah, well... Here it is. There's a theory that out there, I'm sure you've run into it, that a lot of these extraterrestrial visitations, a lot of the, or the people think they're extraterrestrial, may in fact be us visiting here from the future. What do you think about that?
I think that there is... in certain cases, in certain types of cases, not so much of the Men in Black, but more of UFOs, there is a lot to be said for that. Now, again, like the extraterrestrial theory, I don't buy into it as a whole cloth. I don't buy into any theory whole cloth. But there is this tendency for UFO cases, as described, the better cases, to reflect the near future, and I wonder if they are time machines or glitches in time. In the 1896-97 flap, what people were reported to be seeing were the airships that became familiar around World War One, and sort of ended with the Hindenburg just prior to World War Two. They were seeing that type of thing, which did not exist at that time. 20 years later, yes. Then, no. In 1947, Kenneth Arnold, who was an experienced Bush pilot and I believe a Freemason on St. John's Day, which is the patron saint of Freemasons, was flying over the Cascade Mountains, and in the well-known case, saw a group of nine gleaming objects. The lead one, he later sketched, and is often seen with a sketch, is something that looks remarkably like something that we are very familiar with now, stealth aircraft. Only we didn't have any stealth aircraft at that time, nor did we for another 30 or 40 years. And UFOs, as they're being seen now, are in an entirely different category. And I don't have a clean word for that because I'm not living in the future. I'm living in 2009. I'll let you know in 20 years if I'm still around. But there does seem to be an element involved in these cases where things are out of sync with time. However, to get back to the Men in Black for just a minute, because it may reveal something about this, if I may, one phrase attracted John Keel's attention, and in fact, it was used in the Mothman Prophecy movie. Indrid Cold, who was sort of a cross between an alien and a Man in Black, perfect case, kept saying, "I'll see you in time." And it sort of was a non sequitur to anything else that was said. That phrase has showed up in many communication cases, whether they're psychic communications purported or alien encounters or whatever. If anything is said at all, one of the things that gets said is, "I'll see you in time." Another one is, "We are one." That shows up in case after case after case after after case. And no one has correlated those together.
What do you suspect that means, "We are one"?
Yeah, well, "We Are One" became kind of a slogan of the New Age movement, not a movement I'm particularly fond of, but it nevertheless has caught on. It's also the slogan of the Universal Life Church, if I'm not mistaken. But it is something that these beings say. The other thing, though, "I'll see you in time," if you want to bring in a time travel aspect to this, perhaps they're out of sync with time and the universe.
So what you're saying is that
parallel worlds, would they be on the same time sequence? Would time be meaningful? Einstein pretty well threw out the absoluteness of time, and nothing has come along to persuade anyone who is involved in theoretical physics that time is more than a effect of space. And if you don't have reference points, time really doesn't exist. So you have to have at least two reference points so that you have knowledge of how to travel between one and the other to say this takes such and such an amount of time. Time is an illusion, and as you get older, time seems to go by much quicker. That's something I've discovered the hard way. A year when I was 15 seemed like a very long time. When I was 40, it didn't seem so long, and now they seem to go by and lickety-split. So,
yeah, I have experienced the relativity of time myself. It's speeding up.
Sooner or later.
Yeah. Okay, tell you what I want to do. I want to open up the telephone line so that anyone in our audience who would like to call in and with a question or a comment about Men in Black, maybe, ladies and gentlemen, you have had an encounter that you think is Men in Black. Well, here's the person you need to talk to. Here's the person who can sort out what happened to you and help you think through it. The telephone number is 623-444-5889 or toll-free 888-223-4599. I knew I got something wrong there. All right, toll-free is 888-223-4599. As always, if you are outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can send me a flash message by going over to my website. Scroll down. You'll see the link that says flash message. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, Kevin. It's Mike from Kentucky.
Hi, Mike.
How you doing tonight?
Good.
Interesting show tonight.
Thank you.
I have, in my cases of being an investigator over the years, run up upon a case within 50 miles of myself where a gentleman by the name of Oscar Jordan claimed that he had encounters with men in black.
Okay.
He was driving from Memphis, Tennessee to Evansville, Indiana, and up what is called the Purchase Parkway down in southern Kentucky, southwestern Kentucky. He said this black car pulled up alongside of him, and there were two gentlemen in it dressed totally in black, and said their skin was just pale, almost white. It was so pale, and they just looked at him, and he looked at them and thought, man, are you a strange-looking bunch, and said as he thought that, then they sort of slowed down and went back behind him, and eventually he lost sight of them.
Was there any telepathic communication between them?
He said that he felt as though those people knew everything he was thinking. He said he felt like they were, when they looked at him, that they looked right through him. And he claimed that when they turned their head, it was almost in unison, you know, almost robotic-like when the way they turned and looked at him.
All right, Alan, what about this feeling that these guys know everything I'm thinking? Is that common?
Near universal. Not always in the car chase type context, but certainly in a lot of coming to the door type cases. So I'm not surprised at that. Let me ask Mike a question, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, to your knowledge, was this rather good case, was it reported to any UFO agency at all?
I'm having trouble hearing him. You're breaking up.
Was this reported to any UFO agency, Mike?
Pardon me?
Was this case reported to any UFO agency?
I can't really hear the conversation, Kevin.
Okay. Well, Mike, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. I wish we could get the answer to that, but it appears that will not be possible. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Debbie from Columbus.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I wanted to, kind of like in Mike's case, to report something that happened to me. Oh, it's probably been maybe about, I would say about maybe 7 or 8 years ago. Back when my buddies and I were down at Wright-Patterson at the Air Force Museum, I kind of took a look across the base, and I know I've told you this a number of times, Kev, at Hangar 18, and of course, you know, I do a little remote viewing now and then, and that had the Roswell remnants in it. Well, I told my friends I was going to walk, I was going to go check out the hangar and I'd see them later. Well, a couple of MPs walked in front of me and basically told me that if I didn't have special clearance, I couldn't go any farther than where I was at. And so I had to turn around and go back with my group. Anyway, when we were leaving Fairborn to drive back up to Columbus, this black sedan started following us, and the windows were tinted, all tinted black, and I just got this really funny feeling, and Kev, you know, I'm psychic and everything, and I'm able to do telepathic communications and stuff, especially with my two contact experiences. Anyway, my friend, I told him, I said, you need to speed up a little bit, and he's like, well, why? I said, well, you know, just do it. So he sped up a little bit. And the car was keeping pace with us. I mean, it didn't come side by side like in Mike's case with his report, but they were keeping pace with us. So then I told my friend, I said, well, slow down. And he goes, what's going on? And I said, look, just humor me, okay? So he slowed down, and the car slowed down. So I knew that it was some kind of government agents. It could have been men in black. I mean, I didn't really see inside the car. But I could feel this, like, presence. Like they were trying to, you know, invade my thoughts and everything like that. Well, since I'm very strong in my metaphysical gifts, I pretty much threw back a thought at him, you know, which pretty much said, you know, look, I know who you are, I know what you represent, and don't think that you can try to scare me and my friends with anything that you have to say or do, because I'll literally blow you guys into oblivion. And the car turned around and went back the other way. So, I mean, I don't know if that was, you know, men in black or whatever. I tend to think it was, and I don't think it was like the alien men in black. I actually think it was like, you know, a government, you know, black ops type group. But they do exist. They really do exist. I just wanted to share that, and hope Alan got an interest out of it. I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. Thank you. Well, Alan, I have a question about that. Something that occurred as Debbie was speaking, are there cases where you have human agents, human men in black, working side by side with these other entities that are men in black?
There are a relative handful of cases. I would love to have asked her a couple of questions. One would have been about the whether she had gotten a look at the license plate of the car and seen if it was a government license plate. That doesn't necessarily prove anything. But most of the alien men in black cases where there's more than just the encounter of that sort, that's the kind of car that is most frequently described. It's almost a cliche. Large black vehicles, the gas guzzlers, often Cadillacs, often with overly tinted glass, past, I believe, even the legal limit at this point, and pacing people. Sometimes they stop, sometimes they get out, and they're the alien type of men in black. However, if she lives in Columbus, Ohio, near that's not too far from Dayton and Wright-Patterson, which is where a lot of the interesting goodies that the government has been able to accumulate is or was stored. I suspect it's been moved, but there is something interesting she said, and I'm not really competent to render a verdict on her psychic powers or skills. I did work 5 years for the Psychic Friends Network, but that doesn't mean that I can tell from a telephone call what a person's psychic skills might be. But in fact, in my original book, Secret Cipher of the Euphonauts, and there's a chapter in there on this, the advice that I give people who feel a menacing circumstance.
Alan, we'll have to get that advice after this break. It's taking over. Caller, are you willing to hang on till after the break?
Yeah.
All right. You hang in there. We'll get to you right after the break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. We are back. My guest is Alan Greenfield. Alan, I want you to be able to finish the thought, and then we'll take this caller.
Okay, I just wanted to say that in my original book, Secret Cipher, The Euphonauts, I devoted a chapter to how to resist men in black and alien abduction and that sort of thing. And the major point that I stress is they feed on fear. They're sort of vampiric, and they fear. Obviously, this woman from Columbus, Becky, was it?
Debbie.
Reacted. Sorry?
Debbie.
Okay, Debbie. Well, totally off. But she reacted by projecting
energy herself, and whether that involves a psychological or a psychic process doesn't matter. It does appear in many cases to ward off any kind of ill encounter that might take place. And again, that resembles the world of the occult and magic, spelled with a K, than it does traditional nuts and bolts ufology. But I would strongly advise people to fear not. Fear is the mind killer in these cases.
All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
Yeah, having trouble, still having trouble with your phone systems. You're kind of every other word or...
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
So I'll just put my question in. Did I understand that correctly, that supposedly that man in black that he supposedly seen and took a picture of, he talked to, said that he was actually a man in black in training? I kind of find that kind of bizarre. I wonder if he could elaborate on that. And then, two, most of the things I heard about men in black is, you know, they kind of raid your house and take something that they don't want you to have, or they scare you. I didn't know that they were ever involved in any kind of murders. Do you think men in black was involved in some of these murders or strange deaths that he was talking about, or does he believe that some other people were involved in that? And I'll listen offline. Thanks.
All right. Well, the first one is, what about the man in black that you encountered telling you that he is a man in black in training? That is rather unusual, isn't it?
Totally. I don't think I've heard that in any other case. But then, who asks them? I stood up, and again, I didn't stand up to be belligerent. I stood up because my chair was falling apart. And the other people around the table turned and looked at him at that point, and I said, "Who are you and why are you here?" And I will never forget the exact turn of phrase because it was so unusual. It was not "I'll see you in time," or it is "I am a man in black in training," and much more mechanical than I'm able to imitate. It was, in fact, more mechanical than I think any human being could imitate, unless they had some device that would have been very rarefied that far back in time. I don't know what was meant. He did appear youngish, quite youngish. Actually, you probably will find a low-res version of that in your mailbox, and you can judge for yourself, but I would say 20-ish, maybe 22-ish from appearance, although, again, looking very pasty, very short, wide, and moving in a non-typical fashion for a human.
Short and wide. Interesting. And I will tell you why.
Heavily overweight, as is often true in men in black cases. They're the two types are the really almost inhumanly short ones, and they're not noticeable. And then these atypically overweight, but with the same general physical appearance otherwise, the same clothing, the same skin color, and sometimes little inappropriate wires and things coming out of their sleeves and that type of thing. It's, in other words, a lot of little anomalies about them.
What about the caller's question about the men in black being involved in any of these strange deaths? What do you think about that?
I think whatever caused the strange deaths and whatever the source of the men in black cases, not the government cases so much, the strange being cases, the cause of death, the murder, as the guy described it, which I've not used that term, but it does fit the circumstances. strange deaths, I think they are the responsible parties, whatever they may be.
What about the, and by the way, folks, let me give the telephone number out again, 623-444-5889. Or if you need to call me toll-free, you may do so. And the telephone number is 888-223-4599. Or you can send me a flash message if you are outside the USA or outside of Canada. All right, so now let me ask you this about these men. I got a couple of questions here. One, are there reports of men in black actually being in uniforms instead of these black suits?
Excellent question, because I just ran across a case recently where you had both. There were two mysterious men dressed in Air Force uniforms followed by a witness that that I tried to get interviewed on UFO Hunters unsuccessfully, although I thought it was a really good case and I had interviewed the witness, followed by two classical men in black, or I may be getting the order reversed. I don't have the case right in front of me, but
they were not in black. They were in Air Force uniforms.
Well, but no, there were two in Air Force uniforms who were acting much more in unison, even if you allow for military formation. They were in this was in the lobby of a hotel, and was the desk clerk at the hotel who was the witness. Although he has since gone on, he was in college at the time. He has since gone on to be a physicist from a respectable university. So it's not a tall tale type story.
Mm-hmm.
It probably isn't even in the guy's interest to tell it, but he noticed these two guys, and they moved in unison, and they spoke with him and said some of the usual things. They looked like human beings. They looked to be Air Force personnel. And I think the only thing they said was, we have to go now. We're going to miss our flight, as if they had to explain to the desk clerk that. And about 2 hours later, down the elevator, come two classic men in black, the short, but dressed totally in black, pasty-faced, expressionless, doing that funny walk. So you, in that particular case, you had those.
Mm-hmm.
There have been people who have represented themselves as Air Force personnel in or out of uniform, and at one time there was even a rather famous directive issued by the Air Force saying to report any incident of people falsely claiming to be, which of course is a serious felony-level offense,
yeah,
claiming to be investigators operating on behalf of the United States Air Force, and in fact turn out to be their names and their identification is all bogus. Those cases, I'm on the fence about whether those are yet another pose of the, shall we say, non-terrestrials, non-conventional beings,
mm-hmm.
or whether they are, in fact, military personnel, and the deniability is just the kind of deniability that people have come to expect, unfortunately, from the government in somewhat embarrassing situations.
All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling? Hello, caller.
Hello, is this the Kevin Smith Show?
It is, and you're on the air. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
All righty, this is Cher from California. I have a question for Alan Greenfield.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about Dr. Carla Turner? She had a Ph.D. in English, and I believe she and her husband, Casey, lived in Oklahoma or the Midwest, and they were pursued, somewhat harassed by the Men in Black. Some of them were government in the big black cars with the black sunglasses and the hats and the black suits. And some she thought were extraterrestrial. And she used to go, I think it was in the 1990s, she spoke all over the country. She went on the lecture tour. And all of a sudden she had an untimely death due to some rapid acting cancer. I don't want to go on too long, but do you know anything about her case and what happened to her husband? I'll take
I don't know what happened to her husband, but I was acquainted with the case at the time. I didn't know about her. You've told me a new aspect that I didn't know, which was that she died rather suddenly of some... Of course, that does happen, I mean, but it is suspicious, and I have no idea what became of her husband. After she ceased doing lecture tours, she dropped off of my radar. But that, you know, it's a classic case, and I wouldn't be surprised at something like that happening.
You know, the thing that I can't figure out, I mean, it seems to me that when you look at the men in black, you've got humans on one side that are intimidating people to keep UFO information from getting out. On the other side, you have these other than humans intimidating people to keep UFO information from getting out. And then we're hearing now that there, and I mean, you hear it from all kinds of sources, people who have had face-to-face encounters with extraterrestrials, or people who are channeling extraterrestrial intelligences, etc. But you hear that what they're saying is if the governments don't make disclosure soon, then the extraterrestrials will do it themselves. So here you've got men in black, some human, some other than human, trying to suppress the information. And you've got these messages coming from extraterrestrials these days saying we want disclosure. Is there a rift in the opinions of extraterrestrials?
Of course, that's inherently that's a possibility, but let me put it this way. Again, wearing the several hats that I am conversant in.
Okay, you know, it keeps happening because I don't watch the clock, but a break just took over. We'll let you answer that as soon as we come back. Caller, you hang on. We'll get to you as soon as we come back, and we shall return, folks. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And caller, if you'll just hang on a moment, we'll get to you. And Alan, you were about to answer that question. And the question was, is there apparent rift between various types of aliens, or maybe even the same group of aliens, but a rift in their opinions about disclosure of their presence here on Earth?
Well, I'm not sure that a conspicuously strange alien coming to the door and scaring the bejesus out of people by telling them not to report something is actually the intention involved. Indeed, in many cases, that is precisely what sends them screaming to the local radio station or newspaper or whatever, and thus we hear about the case. It works sometimes. Often it does not. So there may be differing motives than are immediately apparent in cases of that sort. Where trans-channeling cases are involved, there is some variety in the message. But again, as I said, when I put on my paranormal research hat, I find that the UFO-related trans-channeling cases, of which I have extensive knowledge, and traditional trans-channeling, which is usually associated with communication with the deceased or celestial beings of a religious sort or whatever, are identical in their structure. In occult circles, they're called communication with praeterhuman intelligences, and people in those circles really resent it when I say it has the same characteristic as UFO-related trans-channeling. I think the sources of these, of many of these messages are as multiple as the number of stations on your AM dial, and it depends on what you're tuned into. And yes, they do have differing tones, differing motivations, and it depends on who or what you're talking to, what kind of message you're going to get. The common denominators are the use of certain key words and names, not all of which are really out there so that they could be imitative. They're clearly coming from a common type of source. For example, Ashtar Command, or Ashtar, which goes back to ancient oracle readings and was often associated with demonic beings in the Middle Ages, and comes right down to us as the UFO-related Ashtar Command. People don't generally have the knowledge of the history of this sort of thing. If it's included in a case, one is inclined to say, well, that verifies that this is something of importance, but the messages are going to vary. And I suspect it's because the agendas vary as much as the agendas
of humans.
AM talk radio stations. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go to the telephone caller. You are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, thank you for holding. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hi, Brent.
Real quick question. I've heard that it's easy to confuse the legitimate men in black. Well, like what, for instance, if they're in the middle of threatening you, if you ask them, for example, boxers or briefs, they'll essentially blow a fuse and not know how to react. I'll take the question. That's the question, is that true or not, and I'll take it offline.
Okay.
It's absolutely true, and it sort of refers back to the much earlier question that came up about the answer that I was given. The Men in Black in training was as a result of my saying something and acting in a way that is atypical of respondents. Well, that's because if a Man in Black shows up at a UFO convention, you're not going to get the same reaction that you do from, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Ordinary in Podunk, Iowa, presumably because we're very familiar with the phenomena. It's just very unusual for that to show up at a UFO convention. In fact, I don't really know of any other instances where that's ever happened. But by asking an unusual question or doing something unusual, it causes unusual reaction.
Well, see, now this explains something to me. It's very enlightening because I've been absolutely flabbergasted by an event that took place when I flew from Phoenix to Los Angeles. And the TSA, anytime, 100% of the time when I fly, 100% of the time, I get the full tilt boogie from the TSA. Okay? There's nothing random about it. You know, take off your shoes, turn out your pockets, go through everything you've got, full body x-rays. And this bozo, and I'm quite well qualified to call this guy a bozo. I've been a cop all my life. This guy is a bozo. Ask me, are you wearing boxers or briefs? Now I understand. He was checking to see if I'm terrestrial or extraterrestrial. Gotta be.
Or he has an unusually a strong attraction for you.
Well, he didn't get the answer that he wanted.
You do say something. It's as if they were scripted.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, that's maybe one of the important points. And
okay, that they're scripted.
Important points.
Yeah.
That if you get off script, you are probably going to throw them off.
Uh-huh.
And if you throw them off, they may not have anything outside of the script. In the early days of computer technology, going back to the mid-1960s, there was an interesting program called ELIZA, which was a mainframe program that you can still find it in some sources. But essentially, it was designed to give interactive answers, although the program just...
I remember that.
Yes. Well, the thing about it is, a lot of people were found to be, in fact, the creator of the program was horrified by this, using this program as a psychotherapist, a Rogerian psychotherapist, who mostly their job is to reflect your question back and rephrase it later and try to get you to come to grips with your own thoughts. My feeling is that there's some aspect of the Men in Black cases where, and this applies to some so-called alien cases as well, although you know the distinction in certain instances is sort of moot. If you say something that is not expected, then they don't have an answer for that, and it fools the programming. And I'm not saying that they are literally a primitive, by today's standard, computer program. What I'm saying is that they may have a limited number of things that they can respond to. And that, again, suggests that we're not dealing with the actual source phenomena, but we're dealing with a secondary energy-generated phenomena that comes from some higher or lower source, according to how you want to evaluate it. And it's a good idea to ask a non-sequitur question. It's always a good idea to ask a non-sequitur question in a situation like that.
All right. We are just about out of time for the show. Alan Greenfield, I want to thank you for being with us. Folks, you can go to his page at Facebook. It is facebook.com/Alan Greenfield. Allengreenfield. Alan, thank you for being with us this evening.
It's been a real pleasure. Anytime.
All right. If you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment. All right, folks, that's a wrap. We are out of here for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.